Kiddos, the roundup is in the top 150 on Podcast Alley. It's June 17th, 2006, and this is the Weekly Roundup, a Mac Observer podcast. I'm Ricky Spiro. This is terrific, man. Thanks to everyone who's voting. For those of you just tuning in, I'm harassing all of you fine listeners during just this month of June, asking you to go to Podcast Alley and vote for this show. The link to do that is it's up at the show notes. If you voted for the show in the past, again, thank you. But you can vote again. You can vote once each month. So if you voted in a previous month, hey, let's get up and go. This is fun, man. Here's an idea. Last time I checked, the Mac Geek Gab was number 111. We're at 149 as I'm recording this. Let's pass the Mac Geek Gab. We need about, 10, 15 votes or something. Let's do it. Let's fight. TMO podcast battle. Go get them. Let's get them. Hey, maybe I can get myself fired. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/roundup. This week, it's PC politics in the spotlight, labor standards, and net neutrality. And in the Context Machine, the host of the show, we're going to steamroll in the Podcast Alley votes. Am I laying this on too thick? Anyway, it's Dave Hamilton from the Mac Geek Gab is going to be here. Okay, here's the news. Working conditions for the employees that build iPods may not be up to U.S. standards. The factories in China where Apple's iPod Nano and Shuffle models are manufactured are staffed primarily by women who work 15-hour days and live in iPod City dormitories with 100 other people. This from a report in London's Mail on Sunday, which claims that employees building iPod Nanos earn about $50 U.S. a month, and that visitors from outside the factories aren't allowed in. Workers in the iPod Shuffle facilities make about $99 a month, but half of that goes back to their food and lodging at the factory. Now, I haven't been reading a lot of comments from articles lately, but these two were the first to surface after we ran this article on Monday. From one guest, "I'm not saying it's right for anybody to have such standards of living, but that is actually a pretty good wage, as I understand it. The fact of the matter is that most people comfortable in our Western standards of living are not very aware of how much the world earns. I believe that these people in these jobs are glad to make that much and to be able to send some of their wage back to their family. I'm glad that this issue can get some visibility. Makes me think twice about all the things I enjoy and take for granted. We are truly blessed." And from another forum member, Biff, "Wait, people in China who assemble products for export to other countries get paid crappy? Dude, I never knew that. Props to Mail on Sunday for once again using the iPod brand to try and get attention for an otherwise pointless article." Well, pointless or not, we're going to take a closer look at the issue, and we're not the only ones who are in the process of doing this. A Wired News columnist, Leander Caney, jumped on the commentator bus with this following catchy tune. "Apple can expect a grilling from its upscale Volvo-driving fans in the months ahead." Whatever Wired might have to say about it. On Wednesday, Apple itself responded to the Mail on Sunday report. Company representatives said that Apple has a code of conduct it expects its suppliers to follow and that it does not tolerate any violations of that code. The supplier code of conduct Apple uses is modeled on the electronic industry code of conduct, which is available as a PDF online. In part, Apple's code of conduct states that suppliers are expected to uphold the human rights of workers and set specific guidelines regarding discrimination, harsh treatment, harassment, involuntary labor, child workers, working hours, employee pay, and freedom of association. The company statement also says Apple is committed to ensuring that working conditions in our supply chain are safe, workers are treated with respect and dignity, and manufacturing processes are environmentally responsible. Apple is now conducting its own investigation. On to that other underappreciated workhorse, the internet. Last week, the U.S. House of Representatives voted against a bill that would have imposed stringent net neutrality requirements on broadband internet service providers. Companies like eBay and Google were in support of the measure, hoping it would protect them from paying premiums to ISPs in order to keep their sites from being significantly slowed down or blocked from consumers. The vote was mostly right along party lines, with Republicans voting against the bill and Democrats voting for it. Supporters of the bill were attempting to prevent a two-tier internet where websites are treated differently depending on how much they pay to ISPs. Opponents say they were preventing unnecessary government regulations. If anyone wants to learn more about net neutrality, I'm happy to recommend the video podcast Ask a Ninja, which did a fine job clearing the whole issue right up. And finally in the news, American technology analyst Sha Wu thinks it's inevitable that Apple will enter the cell phone market, but probably not until mid-2007 at the earliest, and more likely sometime in 2008 or 2009. When Apple finally enters the market, it's likely to offer a well-integrated package similar to iPod and iTunes. Gee, I wish I'd thought of that. Oh, wait, I did 2 weeks ago when I talked about games on the iPod. I was just saying, mobile phone capacity will be one of the last features Apple builds into the iPod, not the most imminent. To Mr. Wu's credit, he does point out that Apple's entry into the cell phone market will require FCC approval, and Apple will have to file for approval at least 3 months in advance. To date, no such filing has been made. So, let's put some of this stuff in context. This is a big collection of issues and stuff going on in these stories. There's all kinds of stuff here, and joining me to talk about it today is Dave Hamilton of TMO and many other hats. Dave, welcome back.
Greetings, Ricky. Thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, let's start we might as well begin with the most callous possible question. Is it a PR problem if Apple or if Apple's suppliers run sweatshops?
Well, you know, I'm just going to jump right to the chase here. I think it's more of a PR problem if Apple announces that their costs just quadrupled on manufacturing everything and that now they're going to have to, you know, either reduce their profits significantly or charge their customers more.
So you think that as a PR issue, if Apple is faced with a choice, if it goes to its suppliers and says, hey, we think that you're running sweatshops, you got to fix that. And they say, well, fine, we're going to double or triple our prices. And Apple has to pass that on. You think that Apple would sooner take the PR hit of dealing with companies that run sweatshops than changing its prices?
Well, you know, and like I said before, this is going to make me sound like a bleeding heart libertarian. Apple's responsibility is to their shareholders, first and foremost, right? I mean, they are a publicly owned company. So they've got to do within reason. I mean, they can't, you know, they can't knowingly go out there and break the law, and neither can anyone else. And if they do, well, of course, they can do whatever they want. If they are found doing that, then there are repercussions, right? I mean, just like for the rest of us. However, their responsibilities to their shareholders. So as long as they are operating within the confines of the international labor laws or international labor practices, they're not doing anything different from anyone else. And yes, it is one of those situations where you have to compare them to everyone else, because frankly, that's what the shareholders do. They decide whether to invest their money because, okay, look, you know, why isn't Apple taking advantage of all this cheap labor? Why are they making all this stuff at home? It doesn't make a difference. The quality in the products doesn't suffer. We don't know if there's anyone breaking any laws. Yeah, Apple's getting a lot of, and I'm not here to be an Apple apologist. I mean, I'm sure Dell does the same thing. Everybody else does it to different degrees and in different capacities. Haven't done all the research, so I don't necessarily have all those facts, but my guess is that Apple's not alone in this. They're just getting singled out because every now and then everyone needs to get singled out. That's just how it goes.
Now, let me press the point here a little bit.
Yeah.
I believe that what you're saying is if Apple were to demand of its suppliers that it stop running sweatshops, or to change its suppliers to people who are have better labor conditions, then you're arguing that that would be irresponsible. It would be a dereliction of duty to the shareholders if Apple did that.
If they could do the same thing for, if they could do the quote unquote right, morally right thing, and that's not to say that they're doing anything morally wrong. This is all, you know, very questionable here. Everyone's coming at this from different points of view. But if they were able to do something that, in the eyes of the world that's complaining about this, seemed better, and yet keep their prices and costs within reason. I mean, you know, maybe if it moves 10 points here and there, maybe that's acceptable. Maybe that's not. Then they should go ahead and do that. But if it's going to mean tripling, quadrupling, or perhaps even increasing their cost tenfold, what's the point there? You know, they're not in business to be the good guys. No one who's in business is in business to be the good guys. You know, they're in business to make money for their shareholders. It kind of drives me crazy that people go out there and you know, dig this stuff up. Without aggregating it across, okay, you know, what about the computer that you typed the article on? You know, what about the cell phone that you called the Apple PR people who didn't give you an answer? What, you know, who made that and what conditions were those made? Who made every single piece of electronics in your Volvo from which you are giving Apple a grilling? Right? I mean, you know, where do you draw this line?
All right. You know. Well, let's back off from that for a second and talk about some of the details here. I think it's worth asking what conditions exactly allow us to define something as a sweatshop.
Yeah.
So according to this article in Mail on Sunday, if currently apparently iPod Shuffle makers, or at least we believe the people making these iPod Shuffles work 15-hour weeks. They earn about $50 a month, and they live in dorms that house about 100 people.
Right.
So how do you make that factory not a sweatshop? I mean, do you pay them $100 a month, $150 a month? Do you put 50 people at a time? I mean, what do you change? What makes when we reach the point, given that there are differences in the value of money in China versus the value of money in the United States and all these other issues and differences in living standards in different countries, how do we make the decision, either as consumers or as labor rights evaluators or anyone else, when do we say, okay, it's not a sweatshop anymore?
I have no idea. My guess is it really depends on what country you're in, right? I mean, if a factory like that, like you just described, and like of course was described in Mail and all that good stuff, existed in the U.S. Oh my goodness! I mean, you can only imagine what would happen outside the place, right? It wouldn't happen, right? It wouldn't even get close to that point, because people in this country have different—I'm not going to say higher, lower, better, worse—different standards of what they're willing to accept and what they're willing and what they're going to complain about. You know, I've never been to China. I don't know if the reporter who wrote the article's ever been to China. You know, has he ever even worked in China? He or she, I don't know if it was a man or a woman. I think all that kind of factors in to a point. I mean, yes, but, you know, the point is these people are humans. And if, you know, if they're being treated in a manner that would be considered cruel by most, then yeah, that's a problem, and that's actually illegal, you know, by international labor practices. So,
So the answer is it's complicated.
It's extremely complicated. Yeah.
Well, let's ask another question.
Okay.
As I've been reading people's reactions to this story on TMO and elsewhere, there are two lines of argument from people who tend to be who tend to like what Apple does,
right?
Shall I call them Apple apologists? Whatever
you want to call them. Right.
The two emerging lines of argument in defense of Apple's practices, or as you've pointed out, many other people's practices in this regard, are: number one, everybody does it, which you were saying before. It's common practice for U.S. firms to do business with Chinese manufacturers or manufacturers in other parts of the world who have lower labor standards than the ones here. Sorry. And the other line of argument is it's not Apple's fault. It's, and then insert the person or the entity or, that's to blame where sure. appropriate, whether it's the U.S. government, international trade policy, the Chinese government, Chinese firms, or right. maybe some, you know, the design of the universe. This is how business is done in the world.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So are you, by and large, comfortable with those arguments?
Well, I mean, I am, only because it's what exists. You know, I'm a very practical person, as those who know me will attest. As long as the people that are working aren't complaining, right? Now, and this gets very touchy here, so I'm afraid, and I haven't rehearsed any of this, so I'm afraid that I'm gonna speak out of turn and stick my foot squarely in my mouth. But that's okay.
While mixing metaphors.
That hasn't stopped me in the past. the issue is, do these people like what they do every day? Are they happy with what they're doing every day? Or are they miserable and can't wait to get out? Now, you know, we project our, and by saying we, I'm saying Americans and those of us in not, you know, non-communist countries, we project our ideals and our standards that's the filter through which we view everything that we see. So, you know, we read this article and take it at face value. Let's just assume it's 100% accurate, which who knows.
Mm-hmm.
That's horrible, right? If any of us had to do that every day, we would complain about it because we've had different and we prefer different. You know, better, right? That's how you define better. You prefer over something else.
Well, and presumably, we're assuming there's nothing in this article that I'm aware of that says these people are not allowed to leave their job. If they
That's
wanted
right.
to step up and walk away from it, they could. They're choosing to work these hours for this money.
That's right. And you know, that's the definition of capitalism, right? Is, you know, one person capitalizing on that which another person chooses to do. If it's, you know, if they don't choose to do it, well, then that becomes racketeering, right? And we've got different laws to deal with that. So, yeah, if they can leave their job, why are we complaining? Why don't we just ask them, you know? But don't ask them by saying, look how good we have it in America, because that's not an option to them. They live in China, right? You know, and so compare it to what their other options are in China. And, you know, I think you're going to find that they've chosen to do this for whatever reason. Now, of course, if they're being coerced into doing it, again, that's, you know, to me, that seems illegal. That's up to the Chinese government to decide, though. So
now there's another question here, which is if you say, well, let's step back for a second and say, let's imagine that these people, they're working $50 a month for $50 a month, not because they want to work there relative to the other things, but because the alternative, whatever other job they could have or unemployment,
yep.
Put them in a truly unacceptable position. And we can imagine whatever that might be.
Right.
Let's say for the moment that we have some moral interest as a society.
Yep.
In seeing that situation improve over time. Whether it's Apple standing up and saying, no, we don't want to do business with you unless you pay your workers more, or some other way of going about it. But
sure.
Let's say that for the moment, let's say we're going to put a moral priority as a society on increasing the amount that people in these factories are earning over time. Where's the place to begin doing that? Do you begin doing that? You've already argued that it's not the responsibility of individual firms doing business with the Chinese to take care of that. But does it begin with the Chinese government, with the U.S. government, with international trade law? I mean, do you have any idea or opinion or intuition about the right place to begin looking for a way to make progress in that regard?
Well, I mean, if Apple has, and when I say Apple, I mean Apple and their shareholders, you know, have an issue with this, and Apple and their shareholders make the decision not to do this, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, and some could, you know, argue that wow, you know, bravo, you've done a wonderful thing. If it's a problem for them, they can choose to do something different, maybe hire U.S. labor or even hire Chinese labor that's not, you know, quote unquote, a sweatshop. you know, then other companies can choose to do the same thing, and the market will sort of, you know, dictate the flow of that. That's one way of doing it. That's my preferred way of doing it. You know, just let the market sort of settle it out. It's all humans involved. It's not like, you know, us and the people reporting on it are the only humans, and then Apple is this, you know, horrible entity that's just dripping with evil ooze and heaven. You know, they need human intervention. No, they're all humans over there too. It's just, you know, they organized under an umbrella they call Apple Inc. So, you know, presumably they're having these discussions internally, hopefully with a little more clarity than I'm providing. You know, they can make that decision and do it, and other companies can make that decision too. If the world wants to get up in arms about it, well, I think, and this is just, you know, my gut, if you want to do that, I think the Chinese government is probably the first place to go. You can
maybe
try
have a minimum wage, for example.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, or maybe have a democracy. You know, there's many, many issues, right? I mean, we can pick, and they can do the same to us, right? You can pick any country out there and say, I want to fix A. And it's like, well, yeah, but A really is, you know, triple Z. We've got many issues in front of that one if you want to make our country like your country. But if you did that, then you're going to buy your labor somewhere else because you don't want to buy your labor in your country for whatever reasons. So, you know.
I think I've lost track of which country is mine and which is theirs based on how this
matter.
Was described. But I believe what you're saying is if there are issues. If you begin putting labor standards in place in China, then people are going to go to, I don't know, places in India. I don't know what the labor standards are in India. I know that, well, anyway. There will be other places. It's a big world.
TMO, for instance, you know, we employ a couple of teams of Russian programmers. Why? Well, two reasons. One, they're cheaper than U.S. programmers. And two, they're happy with their jobs. They aren't going to leave their jobs in search of something better. They found a job that they like, and they keep doing it. You know, in this country, we're very obsessed. And I am the classic example of this. So, you know, bear that in mind. We're very obsessed with furthering ourselves. And by that, we mean getting promotions and making more money and buying more stuff. Right? That's what we do. We consume. We're really good at it. But to do that, we just need to keep getting ahead and ahead. There's, you know, there's a lot of societies, and you know, obviously some people in the U.S. follow this too. You don't need to take that promotion. You don't need to move ahead to move forward happily, right? There's other ways of gauging your life opposed to just your title, you know, at the end of the day. So that's why we hire our Russian programmers, and we're happy to do it. You know, there's many things that we do here that we simply could not do if we had to employ, you know, all U.S. programmers at U.S. wages, and that's just the way that it goes. So
I'm thinking that maybe somewhere in there you admitted that you personally, your own emotional predilection for further advancement is the reason why Apple's using sweatshop labor.
Wow. I don't think I meant to say that.
No.
Is that
okay.
My foot in my mouth again?
No. Let's talk about the bottom line here. What okay. do you think is going to happen? What do you think that Apple or anyone else will do now that this report, this particular report, and it's not like this is the first report about an American firm using sweatshop labor in China, but what do you think is going to happen? Do you think Apple is going to change their practices? Do you think anything here is going to change?
I think this is going to be a slower process than it started out. I do think, you know, because Apple has that media darling title going, this is going to get more attention than it would if it were, you know, another company without, you know, that whole cachet. And I think that Apple will find out a whole lot more about this particular set of factories in China. And you know, it'll play itself out in the press, and Apple just gets to sit and wait and find out what the people think, and then they'll either issue a statement and make a change, or they'll just kind of let it die. I mean, that's what I'd do if I was in their shoes. You come up with a couple of plans, but you don't institute them until you figure out what the answer is.
What you need to do.
Well, yeah.
All right. Well, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about another thing that tends to get people pretty up in arms. This net neutrality bill.
Mm-hmm.
The first question, I know that for me, this kind of came out of nowhere for me. I wasn't following this very closely. How closely did you follow sort of the life and death of this bill as it was coming up in Congress or in the House, and then what eventually happened with the vote?
Yeah, I'd heard about it, but I didn't follow it very closely. I like the way that it, you know, and of course, being involved in the media, I love to poke shots at the way that we all do things. But, you know, the way this bill was portrayed was these companies are going to charge more, and this is the only thing that's stopping them. Well, no, it's not. Nothing has stopped them for 10 years. You know, there's nothing going on. We're looking toward the future with this. So, no, I hadn't really watched a whole lot of it until kind of the bitter end. But I hadn't paid a whole lot of attention to it during its tenure.
All right. So just to give people a general idea of what's going on with this bill.
Yeah.
Can you give some kind of a scenario that, you know, something that exists today, some situation that exists among firms today, or that we could expect to develop soon, and explain what this bill was, how this bill would have changed that scenario, or how that bill would have affected the internet along the way?
Yeah, well, I mean, the idea behind the bill, as I understand it, is that it was basically going to legislate and regulate how internet service providers provided their internet service. You know, it was going to severely limit them in how they can go about connecting, you know, their customer, the you and I at home, or the business, you know, buying internet access to whomever it is they want to get in touch with. And one of the big, you know, the big argument about this, the big light that was shined was, well, now, you know, they can go to Google, AT&T could go to Google or Verizon or Comcast or Cox or whoever you want to, you know, put in there, and go to Google and say, hey, you know, if you still want people to be able to access your sites quickly, you're going to need to pay us a little bit extra, because, you know, otherwise we're going to have to put you on the slow bandwagon there, and I just don't know how quickly people are going to be able to get to you. I mean, well, we'll see how it goes, but there's no guarantees. You know, that's the one that got a lot of press, right? But there's another scenario too, and I wish I'd gotten the person's name. Someone in the TMO comments pointed this out. So, you know, the other scenario is we could have some nefarious Mac advertiser, right? And or Mac company, right? Someone that's not done nice things in the Mac market, and I've got a list of them, trust me. And, you know, they could come to us if this bill were passed, saying no, everyone needs to be treated equally. They could come to us and say, hey, listen, you know, there's that net neutrality bill, and I know you don't like us, but you have to sell us advertising at you know, fair rates, those compared with everyone else. You can't put a surcharge on. You can't deny us advertising. You have to let us advertise. Whoa. You know, do you really want to regulate things? That's not what the law is designed to do, but in the end, it could be twisted in a way that allowed it to be used that way. That's not a good thing. You know, that starts to get pretty dangerous. Again, you know, my bleeding heart libertarian view is shut the bill down. Let the customers decide. So.
Now, for the people who live and die by the internet, mm-hmm. and
I'm one of them.
We and I'm actually thinking of a slightly different character of individual. You are one of them in the professional sense. I mean, you do many of the same things. You blog, you podcast, you're livelihood is earned through the internet.
I published some little online magazines here and there. Yeah.
Right. So, but maybe the term I'm looking for here is internet apologists. We talked about Apple apologists. The internet apologists, whatever that means, have always been the ones who wave the no regulation banner. Yeah. My impression from a lot of people who live and die by the internet, or who just love being on the internet, is that they were behind this bill. They wanted to see this passed on the theory that it would protect independent media, that it would protect right. You know, non-commercial activity on the internet,
right.
In the same way that people have been very excited about the alternative media of blogging and podcasting, that
right.
gives you the opportunity to get a hold of not commercial media, and many other things, not commercial commerce.
Yep.
What does that mean?
Well, you
I'm
know,
confused. Not big business commerce.
Not big business. Yeah, because you use that term non-commercial, and nothing on the internet exists non-commercially, right?
Right.
Even the guy that's posting a blog, he may not be making money from it, but he's paying to host it somewhere, presumably. You know, mm-hmm. even if he's hosting it at his house, if his provider lets him do that, well, that, you know, that's a service he's paying his provider for. So. You know, everything on the internet is for pay. It didn't start that way, right? I mean, the government kind of planted the seed, you know, 30-something years ago, maybe more than that. But then they released it into the wild, and now the tree's grown, you know, and actually there's a forest.
There's a jungle.
There's a jungle. Yeah, that's actually a much better analogy. Yeah.
So it is your opinion that there's, I mean, is there a hypocrisy in that argument? You know, net neutrality, is there a fundamental hypocrisy there, or am I missing the priorities? Is it that the people who are behind this bill are not so much on the no regulation bandwagon as they are on some other bandwagon?
Yeah, they might be. You may have hit the nail on the head. They may be out looking to protect what it is they do. I mean, would it impact TMO? It could very well, right? If it not, it has, you know, not if the law doesn't pass, but if someone chooses, some company chooses to go ahead and offer tiered access to their customers, right? I mean, that's what this is talking about. It's not getting more money from their customers. It's actually creating a second customer base, right? The people providing information, mm-hmm. Google, Yahoo, TMO, right? I mean, we all sort of provide the information the same way. So they could, you know, come to us and say, look, you know, if you want our customers to be able to get your content faster or at all, you got to pay us, otherwise we're going to shut you out. And that's their choice. Again, it's, you know, their choice. If they're privately held, then it's whoever owns it internally. And if they're publicly held, then it's their shareholders. And, of course, remember, the people on the other end of the equation, the customers paying the bills. You know, if every company goes out there and does this, well, then there's nowhere to turn. But that's not how capitalism has typically worked, right? I mean, there's, you know,
if there's nowhere else to turn, generally someone pops up and says, you can turn
monopoly.
Here.
Right. That's someone plops up, right? There is a business opportunity. That's right. Will it be a mess for a little while? Yeah, it could be. I don't think that we're going to see any of the major players that are, you know, delivering bandwidth to homes and small offices. I don't think we're going to see any of them shutting out, you know, well, you're not going to be able to access Google anymore because we want you to access our search engine. Right? I don't think we're going to see that happen. I think worst case, and I could be wrong, worst case is that they're going to say, well, yeah, Google's on the slow tier there. You know, if you want Yahoo, well, that you get that real quick. But Google, well, it might take, you know, 10 seconds instead of 1 second. And that could be a mess. Even just that's pretty huge, you know. But that it'll settle itself out. It may take 5 years, but the internet's moved and evolved very, very quickly.
And in many respects, so, people tend to be pretty vocal about the stuff that they want access to on the internet.
Yeah,
I mean, it seems hard to believe that customers would say, you know, that it would suddenly start taking 10 seconds to pull up Google's homepage, and people wouldn't get loud about that.
I would imagine, yeah. Yeah. Again, I mean, they're paying the bills. You know, the ones they have to answer to are their customers eventually. And if they don't, they will go out of business. I mean, that's just how it goes. That's life. You know, like you said, someone will pop up, offer something better, and if it's that much better, off they go. So.
And I want to say that's the final word. I feel like we've been going at such a high clip here.
We have.
It's hard to mellow everything out. Anything else you want to get off your chest before we head out?
I've had a couple things at home bother. No, never mind.
All right. In that case, it's definitely time to go. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. And thanks, everybody, for listening. I know this is probably a whole lot longer than they thought this would go on. So,
cheers. If you have questions or comments about the news, or if you want to express your own opinion about this whole thing, I'd love to hear what you guys have to say about this, and I will make sure to pass along anything that you have to say about this, about what Dave feels about this, to him as well. And we'll just go on continuing the conversation as long as required. The email is roundup@macobserver.com. And in spite of the slightly greater length of this show, I'll still do a quick product roundup. VisiFX announced the immediate availability of Image Machine on Wednesday. Image Machine is a universal binary application that uses a drag-and-drop interface to apply effects to groups of images. It's priced at $20. PlayFirst announced the immediate availability of three games, Plantasia, Subway Scramble, and Trijinx, a Christine Cross mystery. Each game is priced at $20. Freeverse Software on Wednesday shipped Wingnuts 2, Reyna's Revenge. Players once again battle Baron von Stopwatch, the mysterious Reyna, and a robotic air force of planes and dirigibles from throughout history through 30 levels of action. Wingnuts 2 costs $30. Parallels released its first official version of Parallels Desktop for the Mac on Thursday. The software lets you simultaneously run operating systems on an Intel-based Mac, including Windows, Linux, FreeBSD, Solaris, OS 2, Ecom Station, I'm not sure I've even heard of that before, or MS-DOS. It also lets you exchange documents between Windows and Mac OS X. Parallels Desktop for the Mac will be regularly priced at $80, but costs $50 for the next 30 days. Humble Daisy announced the immediate availability of ProfCast 1.5 on Thursday. ProfCast is a lecture and recording and podcast creation and distribution application. It's priced at $35. Trans International released serial ATA mobile hard drives for the MacBook and MacBook Pro on Monday. For capacities and pricing, you can visit the show notes at macobserver.com. And finally this week, if you're worried about your Mac getting jacked, this week John Braun reviewed Jack SMS. And that's the news. Thanks for listening to the Weekly Roundup. Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom for TMO. Thank you all so much for listening. Head out there and vote, man. We only got a couple weeks left, and we got to steamroll the Geek Gap. We're just going to take them down. It's going to be sweet. Stay subscribed, everyone. Until next week, I'll see you online.